You're listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and the people who play them. My name is Eran Aviram.
My name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello.
And today we'll discuss props, everything around the game table that is not actually part of the game, and most of the time not part of the table as well. What is it, props, Uri?
Well, let's start with a definition. For the purpose of this episode, when we say props, we mean any additional implement that you may add to your game that are not an inherent part of the game mechanic. And when I say inherent part of the game mechanic, I mean using dice, a grid map, miniature, character token, counters. All of these, for the purpose of this episode, are part of the game mechanic. These are things that you need in order to run your basic game if you're using them. What I do count as props for this episode could be game-related apparel, mood setters, actual props or handouts. We will go over all these in a minute and make some suggestions as how you can level up your gaming experience by using those.
So generally speaking, if I understand correctly, all of these are things that can enhance your game, but you don't need for your game.
Precisely.
Okay. And also, they are all physical. They are about the physical space in which we play the game.
Indeed.
Okay.
I hardly use props anymore in my games. And I used to use props all the time, and it got me thinking about why that is. And I think the answer is that I usually run my own adventures. So every prop is something I have to make by myself for this specific adventure.
Mm.
And that is just so time-consuming.
I mean, compared to published modules, where you sometimes get already some sort of player handouts, like art, all sort of art or letters or stuff that you can hand. Like for Call of Cthulhu, there are several huge boxes of campaign material that also come with dozens of props that you can hand to your players that really enrich the game.
Paizo is also doing amazing work with their handouts and, you know, all around. We have come to a point in our hobby where published adventures could be of really high quality that they include handout, they include artwork, they include the basic standard nowadays is pretty amazing.
Yes, they have a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and basically this whole episode is a way for me to try and inspire both you, our dear listeners, as well as myself, your dear host, to get back on the prop wagon and improve your game.
Okay.
So let's start at the very basic, at handouts. Those little sheets of paper that a GM would hand off to the players. Now, handouts are probably the most common prop there is. They are basically just pieces of paper with a depiction of the information or images that the characters are exposed to. I usually use handouts either when the party discover a letter, a scroll, or any other actual parchment with writing on it. These can be messages, riddles, or ciphers, or anything else you may want. But handouts may also be pictures of the current location or a map of the current town or kingdom.
Mm.
This reminds me of a time when I was in the museum and I saw a whole set of etchings by James McNeil Whistler. There will be a link in the show notes. They were all in the theme of the Thames and other rivers across Europe. And that inspired me so much that I design a whole town in my campaign based on these etchings. And whenever the players arrive to one of these locations in town, I simply show them the etching that was the inspiration for this specific location. And it worked because the etchings were all of the daily life of Amsterdam and London.
Mm.
There was an etching of a person whose job was to fix the roofs of houses. And I looked at that and I said, oh, this is an amazing NPC. This is someone who knows the rooftops of the city really well. And that became the leader of the rogue guild because all the rogues would, you know, travel the city on top of the rooftops. And that's one of the things that both inspire me. And because I took the extra effort to prepare the handouts and base them on something in the real world. Now, of course, you can go the extra mile with handouts. If they're a scroll, you can roll them up and bind them with a ribbon of some sort. You can close them off with a wax seal. You can simply take them and submerge them into a pot of coffee, and seem like an old scroll, this, or burn the edges off. These are old, you know, basic tropes of how to prepare an old scroll lookalike thing. But the point is that all of these are something that you can simply pull out of your GM bag, hand out to the players, hence the name handout, by the way, to your players, and let them marvel at, you know, your creativity, or let them try and read that specific cipher which you basically just made by typing the message and then changing the font to a foreign language. I actually did that, and they solved it in like 2 minutes. I was so pissed off. But hey, you know, great props for them. And now we can move on to discussing actual props. And actual props are really nice. These can be actual riddle devices, like a locking puzzle box, which you can order now from Wish or AliExpress or anywhere for dimes. Or simply a representation of some really important in-game item. In one of my games, there was this talisman who had amazing powers. This was like the MacGuffin of the whole campaign. But the talisman was also able to corrupt its holder. So I bought this knick-knack of a pendant, brought it to the table, and we used it to keep track on who is currently wearing the necklace.
Sure, okay.
Now, when the necklace had an impact on the game, I could immediately see who is the player whose character would be impacted. It really added to both the realism and to the sense of foreboding that came with holding the talisman. Now, when the player would see my eyes darting between them, looking at their neck, seeing who has the talisman, that was a really telltale sign and an excellent way of creating suspense. This would also cause the player in question to feel the burden of responsibility. I mean, you can't forget that you have the dependent now. There is something literally hanging around your neck that has a physical manifestation in the real world. It's not something that you might have scrawled on your character sheet and maybe you don't remember. Also, when you start the gaming session and you say, okay, whoever has an item of power, please put them on you. It's a really good getting into character moment.
For a great example of some actual props, especially puzzle devices, I would highly recommend everyone watch Relics and Rarities. It's a show by Geek and Sundry, and where Deborah Ann Voll, who you might know from Daredevil, she was Karen Page there, and she's a great GM, and she's really, really super into riddles and all sorts of mysteries. That's what she likes about running games. So in Relics and Rarities, which is a high production, high volume show where they brought all sorts of actors to be special guests in every episode, she created some physical props, pretty, again, high quality stuff. Like there was this actual puzzle box that she created and gave them and handed them, and they had to actually solve it and open it. And that was a great moment when she pulls it out. You know, when you are the GM who creates awesome stuff, the moment you bring it out, all of the players' eyes, you can just see them widening with appreciation and surprise, and they love just waiting to see what's the next thing you're going to pull off. So she pulled off some pretty cool stuff. Check out Relics and Rarities.
Of course, this brings us back to the age-old question of player versus character. You know, people saying, yeah, I can't do this complicated box, but my character is awesome. She can definitely do that. But, you know, it's still awesome to try, and even if you can't do that because you're not a level 9 wizard, it's still, you get the sense of the tactile sensation, the real-world representation of what it is that your character can do, even if you can't.
Yes.
I would also like to talk about apparels, clothing, and the likes. Now, I don't know a lot of tabletop RPG groups that actually dress up as their characters. Most people who are into that kind of full immersion usually prefer to just LARP.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is nothing wrong with suggesting that for a specific session, all the players will wear what their characters would have worn should they were living in the here and now.
Okay, sure.
I hope I got all the tenses there right.
I mean, that allows you to, instead of go to some sort of medieval inspired shop and shop for something new, wear whatever you already have, but inspired by your character. So you don't actually need to work hard in order to accomplish this.
No, I think most of the hard work is mental.
Yes.
Because you need to think, okay, my character would be here and now, what would they wear? And this could be really simple, you know, for the player playing the party berserker to simply wear a Rage Against the Machine t-shirt.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That's how I imagine a berserker nowadays. Or for the wizard to simply put a big shining ring or hat or a really cool elaborate hat on his head. You know, one of those things that really stands out. So even taking the opportunity to simply have something on you, an item of clothing, a scarf perhaps, a handkerchief in your pocket, something that you think your character would have liked, I find that to be an amazing way to both get into character and to simply lively up the session by using a really simple prop.
I really like it. Maybe I'll use it next time. Maybe I'll ask my players.
Definitely do that.
Looks like it's
fun. Amazing. Like always, it's amazing what people would think of when you give them such an open-ended idea.
Mm.
And as we all know, role players are the best.
The best people, yes, yes.
The best people.
Yes, of course.
The next point I want to bring up is mood setters. Things that sets the mood. Now, there are plenty of mood setters that can be used to set a specific mood for a gaming session. I'm going to give a few examples, and I'm sure you can think of many, many more on your own. Number one would be the lighting. Changing the lighting of the room. You can make the room where you play a little bit lighter or darker than usual. This has an amazing effect.
Mm.
The first time I tried that, I made the room a little bit darker, and everyone sat down, and one of the players immediately stood up and said, okay, I'm going to turn the light on. No. It's intentional. And there was a moment when she looked at me, you know, with that suspicious stare of, why are you not telling us something? Have you not paid your electrical bill? What happened? And then like, oh, because we're in a dungeon. And I'm, yes, because you're in a dungeon. And that, you know, light bulb moment is what we do this for. And you can also go as far as lighting a few candles or changing one of the light bulbs to a colored light bulb. It's amazing how much technology can help us with this. Second idea is, of course, music. Now, I personally tend not to use music in my games because I improvise a lot and I don't want to distract myself by giving me something else to keep track of.
Yes, yes.
But if you do want, there are amazing solutions. We've mentioned countless times in this podcast, tabletopaudio.com, where you can simply pick a background music, press the play button, and let it play in the background. I've used it once, and it was amazing.
I use something else. It's called Melodice. It's at melodice.org. It's a soundtrack, general sort of soundtrack, or various YouTube videos that together create a playlist of soundtracks for whatever. It's meant to be used in the background for board games, actually. But I used it, I searched for pirates, and I used it for in the first few sessions of our pirate game. And it was great. It was a lot of fun.
There is also, of course, the Sirenscape app. If you're familiar with it, if you're running a Pathfinder adventure path, some of them are coming with a preset audio soundtrack for each phase and encounter in the adventure. These are amazing and have quality up the wazoo. It's amazing. You would You notice that I mentioned that I don't use music in my games a lot, but the reason I can say this with so much certainty is because I don't always run the game. I played with many, many game masters, and some of them used music beyond anything I could have imagined. Still to this very day, there are some songs that if I would hear wherever I will be, I would freeze and take a step back and think, okay, I need to roll stealth now really high because of the emotional Pavlovian reaction that I have when my GM would play this song in specific encounters or specific situations. So music really stays with you. And since I don't do this, another suggestion would be to delegate this responsibility to a player that really like music or setting soundtrack.
Yes.
And you can ask them to handle the background music if that is not too distracting for them.
Yes.
Another great mood setter is smell. You know, there's a reason why when you're on a romantic date, you would light scented candles. And that reason is that you want to create a specific mood. And you can use that same principle in your game. Simply light up a scented candle or an incense. They're dime a dozen and they have an amazing effect, especially if used sparingly. And I want to stop for a moment and focus on that word, sparingly. Pretty much all the props that we've mentioned can either be used as a one-time thing or as a marker for something. Now, a prop symbolizing a talisman is something that marked this talisman. It's a marker for this item. You can use a specific music as a marker for a specific character. This is the same music for this character.
Yeah, like
or for this. Yeah. And you can also use specific soundtrack as markers for a specific location. This is the noise of this town. Mm. This is the background noise of Riddleport. But you can also use things just for one specific moment, for one specific encounter, for one specific epic culmination of your campaign. For example, if only when the characters are entering the dragon lair, you would light an incense to get that smoky, dangerous feel in the air, that would create a much greater effect than if you would use it anytime they're underground.
Mm.
So it's important to bear in mind to have some balance between I want to make this special and I want to make this more focus for the player, to focus their attention on this one item or one location or one encounter. And I want this to be a general tool to help me immerse my players in a specific campaign.
Excellent. And I think if we're talking about immersion, my thing and my only thing that I have to add to this is food and snacks, which are, I think, probably best used to facilitate the experience of getting into a specific culture, because food is very much related to culture. If I'm going to eat, for example, malawach, for me, that's a very Middle Eastern thing. And if I get to eat it during a session, it invites these feelings, these thoughts, maybe even the smells, by the smells of the food, of this scenery in a Mediterranean town. The problem with food is that you need to make it. You need to create it. It's not necessarily a big problem. You can also order it. I mean, there are probably places you've never ordered from in your whatever website you use to order from, because they are unusual and they have these strange cultural heritages that you just don't understand. What is Pakistani food, for example? Well, how about you order it once, try it out, and see to yourself, can this fit halflings in my world? And I'm going to say that when they arrive at this and this town, where it's in the middle of a place down the mountains and there's this strange and unusual forest around and the people here eat this sort of food, can I use this food for this? Because if so, then it's going to make the encounter of actually meeting these people and sitting with them and eating their food a lot more intimate and in a way memorable, because now I not only remember the description that GM gave, maybe the smells that he created, I will also remember the taste of the place I was in. And also, of course, the mere act of eating is so unusual around the table. Usually we stop to eat. Usually we don't eat during the session, I think. I mean, you snack. But if you really want to eat during a session, you probably stop and have a half an hour of actually eating and then go back. So the act of consuming food is such a disruptive thing in the middle of a session that it has to be memorable. If it is part of the session, you can't ignore, forget about that time you sat and ate with the Pakistani leader. I don't know, whoever it is that you eat with.
Pakistani, halfling, elven,
sure,
whatever.
Sure, whatever it is that you decided this food will work for in your world. So that's great. And the other side of this is snacks. Because snacks are the thing that you eat throughout the game, and they are always on the table, and some people don't order anything or don't bring food, they just eat snacks. Usually I would recommend healthy snacks, but they can also be unusual snacks. Like if for some reason the people of the land you're going for, it's some sort of maybe a desert land or tundra, you can bring a lot of dry food, jerkies, or of all sorts of heavily salted or taste like they are heavily salted pieces of food that you will eat during the journey that you are doing through this tundra, to give the players the sense of what their characters sort of eat during this time. And it might not be pleasurable, it might not be yummy snacks, definitely, but they are, again, memorable snacks.
So we've talked about props, how you can take physical objects in the real world and use them to enhance your gaming experience and to make this whole game more memorable for your players and for yourself, to create a more immersive experience, and simply to use it as a way to emphasize and bring forth specific elements of your game. That sounds awesome. Eran, why am I not doing that as much as I used to?
Because it's a lot of work, Uri.
But then again, that's GMing for you.
I will disagree. However, if if someone in our audience is already doing some or any of the things we just discussed, I would love to hear about it. First of all, how effective was it? What did you achieve with it? And second, indeed, how much work was it? And is it something that maybe it's actually easier to do than we imagine? Contact us at show@dwarfcast.net. But now we continue to take the load off.
This world is carried on the shoulders of the dwarves.
This is the part of the show in which we talk about role-playing games in our personal lives. Uri, what is personal about you?
Well, I'm having the best time because my GM in my current Pathfinder campaign is doing a whole project of self-improving himself to take himself to the next level as a GM. I can't really tell you everything that this includes, but I'm having the best time just being a player at the table. This is, first of all, this is an amazing project in my eyes, because I love the fact that people are serious enough regarding this hobby to take it to the next level, to take the time and, you know, listen to podcasts like ourselves and to watch actual play and learn from the GM they see in actual plays and make lists of what they're doing better and what are their weak points and try to work on those. And in the last few sessions, my GM, who's amazing, by the way, he was amazing before this whole project started, started using a few extra methods and systems and ideas that he got from all over the place. And every session, there's a little bit of something new. And it's wonderful, both from the metagaming perspective, because I, as I'm sure our listeners already figured out, am a big fan of role-playing and everything that goes around it, beyond it, the meta of it, and the actual doing of it. And I love seeing the process of improvement, and I love trying out these various ideas and see what mesh better with the high mechanic system like Pathfinder, and what clashes there and what really bring out the best in some players and other players just don't understand what is this new idea, why can't we just play rules as written.
That sounds really interesting, Guri. Can we maybe hear more about it in some future episode?
We should. I'm just going to let him continue and reach some more conclusion. And I would love to bring him over and to have him discuss the process.
Excellent.
You know, how does one improve one GMing? How does one try out things? And till then, I'm just really enjoying myself.
Excellent. I just came back before this episode from another chapter of our ongoing pirate story in 50 Fathoms using Savage Worlds. And it was a lot of fun. When we just started the campaign, I brought in a concept from One Piece, which is an anime, the longest running manga in the world, I think, probably. It's called Devil Fruit, and it gives you special powers when you consume it. It sort of allows everyone to become a superhero in a way. And it's great in a world where there are wizards and people who are not wizards. And you want the people who are not wizards to have some special cool abilities as well. So they'll be able to, during their turn, decide, do I want to activate this thing or do I want to attack, etc., etc., etc. Of course, they can't be too complicated because, first of all, these people didn't decide to play wizards, so they don't want anything too complicated. And second of all, this is Savage Worlds, so everything needs to be fast, furious, and fun. So each devil fruit, in our world, they're called deep fruit or fruits of the deep. They give you a single ability, a single thing you can do, and that thing can be interpreted in interesting ways, so you can hopefully think of creative ways to use it during the game. They're getting stranger and stranger as the game continues, again, going inspired by One Piece. So we had, for example, today, a captain of a ship that could create candy, any sort of candy. So when the ship of our valiant heroes turned to try and run away from them because they were a lot bigger and they were chasing us, he created a cake under the ship, a really, really big cake, which lifted the ship off the water. And that was great fun. And then all of the fight with him, he sort of bled candies and it was great fun. And of course, weird. I would not recommend it in any pirate game. Not that every fruit creates such crazy zany powers, of course, but they do create some zany situations because that's how we play. We play it a bit cartoonish-like. So we can sometimes go and indulge ourselves with, candy pirates. We are approaching the end of the campaign anyway, so this is the time to push all of the craziest things, and I think the craziest are still to come. Yes. That was us, and if you would like to say anything, do so by emailing us at show@dwarfcast.net. Of course, you can also join our Facebook group or look for us everywhere on the internet, Twitter or Facebook at Dwarf Podcast. If you want to give us a rating of 5 stars, 5 hands up, 2 eyes looking sternly forward, I don't know, all sorts of rating system in the world, please do so. We would highly appreciate it because it really helps other people find us. Of course, the other thing that helps other people find us is you. So if you would like to recommend us or any of our specific episodes, when you are conversing with your friends about this and that, please do so. We would love it. Dwarfcast.net. That's the address that you can Woohoo! Give them. And this is it. Uri, do you have anything else to add?
Yes, I would like to add more handouts to my campaign.
Love it.
Later!
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by Attribution Non-Commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Duo. And you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.